From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The talented Mr. Ripley is out on video. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, we hear from Anthony Minghella, writer and director of The Talented Mr. Ripley and The English Patient, for which he won Oscars for Best Director and Best Picture. The X-Men movie opened today. The executive producer is Stan Lee, the creator of such comic book superheroes as the X-Men, Spider-Man, The Incredible Hulk, and The Fantastic Four. We'll feature a 1991 interview with Stan Lee. And guest film critic Henry Sheehan reviews Chuck and Buck. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Ann Bozell. After 2 years and 157 witnesses, a Miami jury has ordered tobacco companies to pay $145 billion in punitive damages to six smokers in Florida. Smokers' attorney Stanley Rosenblatt says this is a day of reckoning for the tobacco companies.
Six thoughtful, courageous Americans listened quietly and carefully to testimony for close to 2 years, and damn it, they did the right thing.
He said the trial was not about money, but about showing the companies for what they are. But speaking on CNN, Philip Morris attorney Dan Webb said he's confident the verdict will be reversed on appeal because of the many errors committed by the court.
The fact that the judge allowed a jury to award such an enormous amount of punitive damages to hundreds of thousands of unidentified and unknown smokers without hearing any evidence whatsoever about the validity of the claims has never happened before in American history and undoubtedly will never happen again.
Today's $145 billion award is by far the largest ever in U.S. history, far surpassing the $5 billion Exxon had to pay following the Exxon Valdez oil spill. It took a jury in Waco, Texas, just 5 hours today to find the government was not responsible for the deaths of Branch Davidians in 1993. About 80 sect members died in a federal raid on the compound following a 51-day siege. Remaining Davidians and family members had sought $675 million in their wrongful death lawsuit. In Russia today, talks between the country's regional bosses and the lower house of parliament ended in deadlock. That sets the stage for the Duma to strip the governors of power, as President Vladimir Putin would like it to do. The BBC's Stephen Deal reports from Moscow.
President Putin has made it clear since his election 100 days ago that he believes that, under his predecessor Boris Yeltsin, too much authority in Russia slipped away from Moscow to the regions. Mr. Putin fears that, if this process were allowed to continue, its logical conclusion would be the breakup of Russia. He wants to remove the immunity from prosecution of upper house members, and ultimately wants the right to appoint them. Seeing their privileged positions under threat, members of the upper house have been fighting for their existence. A two-thirds vote next week by the Duma against the upper house could see it dissolved, paving the way for Mr. Putin to create the sort of Federation Council that he wants.
The BBC's Stephen Deal. On Wall Street, the Dow Industrials closed up 23 points today, the Nasdaq Composite was up 72 points, and the S&P 500 was up 14 points. Trading today was moderate. You're listening to NPR News. The Senate has voted to phase out estate taxes over the next 10 years. Nine Democrats joined with the Republicans to pass the measure, but that won't be enough to support an override of an expected veto by President Clinton. A group of prominent outsiders today released recommendations on how Major League Baseball can solve its economic problems. The recommendations include substantial increases in the amount of revenues which teams share and possible team relocations. NPR's Tom Goldman reports.
The recommendations came with a warning. The economic problems that led to the players' strike in 1994 are worse and need fixing. Former Senator George Mitchell, a member of the special panel, said baseball has become a caste system in which only high-revenue, high-payroll clubs have a chance to win a championship. The panel of Mitchell, former Federal Reserve Chairman Paul Volcker, Yale President Richard Levin, and political commentator George Will recommends a 50% tax on team payrolls over $84 million. Also, teams should share up to half of all local revenue, and there should be a central fund to help low-revenue teams. The panel is not proposing a cap on players' salaries. The recommendations are not binding, but players and owners undoubtedly will study them as they prepare to negotiate a new labor contract. The current one ends next year. Tom Goldman, NPR News.
Daimler Chrysler is recalling nearly 700,000 Dodge Ram pickups because of faulty ignition switches and wiring. The recall is for the model years 1994 to 96. A company spokesman says there have been no injuries or accidents because of the problem, but there have been some fires in the steering column. I'm Ann Bozell in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and Alltel at alltel.com, providing telecommunications solutions to more than 8 million customers.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The talented Mr. Ripley has come out on video. On this archive edition, we have an interview with the writer and director of the film, Anthony Minghella. Minghella also directed the film adaptation of The English Patient. The Talented Mr. Ripley is adapted from a novel by Patricia Highsmith. As the story begins, a wealthy industrialist wants to convince his son Dickie to return home from the bohemian life he's living in Italy. The father mistakenly believes that a young man named Tom Ripley is Dickie's old chum from Princeton. When the father offers to fund Ripley to go to Italy and talk Dickie into coming home, Ripley plays along with the father's mistake and pretends to be Dickie's old friend, because Ripley's broke and he wants the free trip. Once Tom Ripley arrives in Italy and gets a taste of Dickie's life, his money, and his freedom, Ripley wants it for himself. Rather than bringing Dickie home, Ripley stays in Italy, attaches himself to Dickie, and finally appropriates Dickie's identity. In this scene, one of Dickie's friends, played by Philip Seymour Hoffman, is looking for Dickie, who has disappeared. The friend pays a visit to Tom Ripley, who's living in a fancy apartment that he says he's sharing with Dickie.
Did this place come furnished? Like, it doesn't look like Dickie. It's really horrible, isn't it? It's so, bourgeois. You know, in fact, the only thing that looks like Dickie is you.
Hardly.
Have you done something to your hair?
Is there something you'd like to say, Freddy?
What?
Do you have something you'd like to say?
I think I'm saying it. Something's going on.
The Talented Mr. Ripley is the story of someone who crosses the line in trying to recreate himself and live the kind of charmed life he envies.
The film asks the question, I think, at a central point. It asks whether it's better to be a fake somebody than a real nobody. And I think at the heart of the film is a kind of debate about the cost of giving up on yourself, the cost of, in some ways, buying into what are, I think, even more prescient messages now than they were 50 years ago about personality, about the value of who you are. I think we live in an age where there's so much of a barrage of messages from the media about changing ourselves, about in some way feeling that we are intrinsically inadequate as human beings, and that what we have, our actual talents, are things we should trade in favor of better hair or better bodies or better lives or better wives or better couches or better something. And so I think what attracted me to the story was the opportunity to look at the moral phrasing of this, and also the fact that as a narrative, it talks about somebody who perhaps appears to get away with what he's doing. And I think the film tries to examine the difference between public accountability and private justice.
What is it that Tom Ripley most envies and wants that Dickie, the wealthy young man in Italy, seems to have?
Well, I feel that if you were trying to compare the two characters, One of them is a man who walks into a room and says, "Hello, I'm Dickie Greenleaf, love me," and people do. And Ripley walks into a room and says, "I'm Tom Ripley, might you love me? I know you won't." And so I think in some ways what he aspires to is the sense of being selected that seems at the heart of Dickie's personality, his expectation of being embraced, whereas I think that Ripley has an expectation of being rejected. I think he feels that he has to lock away who he intrinsically is, because if people actually saw him, they would reject him. And I think that's something which I certainly can relate to, and I think is part of the human condition in some way. I think that one of the, I suppose, phenomena of traveling from childhood into adulthood is an essential recognition that we're alone and an essential desire not to be alone.
You know, as you said, Tom Ripley, the character, says it's better to be a fake somebody than a real nobody. Frank Rich, writing in the New York Times Magazine section, said, "In this age of rampant reinvention, when political candidates, entrepreneurs, and criminals change selves like quicksilver, the talented Mr. Ripley may be Hollywood's most chilling and up-to-date portrait of our national character." What do you personally relate to about the character of Tom Ripley? Because there must be some personal connection there.
Oh, I think I felt huge connection to Ripley when I read reread the novel when I came to adapt it. I think essentially it's this feeling of being on the outside of things, of being strange in some way, of feeling too that you have to be secret about what makes you particular. That I suppose it goes back to the sense of being in a schoolyard when teams are being selected, and the fear of not being chosen, the fear of not being admitted really to a life that you aspire to. And particularly in Britain, where I was brought up, where I think the issues of class are tattooed on your forehead, you walk around with second rate and second class imprinted on your forehead, then I think that I'm very, very alert to the striations of class and to the sense that there's a better life being lived, that your nose is pressed up against the window of a life. And you know, my family is Italian, and I was growing up on a small island off the coast of Britain, so I felt there were so many membranes between me and what seemed to be the center of things. And that, you know, I don't want to make any special claim for that, because I think all of us have within us some reference to what it feels like to be on the outside. And those were my particular things. I mean, I was perfectly happy growing up. It's just that I always felt in some way that I didn't entirely belong. And I think that feeling of not belonging is particularly exacerbated in, you know, late adolescence, early adulthood, which is really where this story is situated. It's very much a story of young people trying to reinvent themselves in the country of Italy, in Europe, which I think had particular attraction to Americans over the course of this century.
What's different here is that, you know, the main character takes these feelings that many of us experience of loneliness and alienation and jealousy. He takes it to extremes. He crosses the line and becomes kind of pathological. Why do you think it's interesting to build a story around a character who we can all identify with, but have him go much further in horrible ways than we would hopefully go?
Well, because I think it's a parable in some ways. I mean, I couldn't help thinking that moment where Ripley says, "I'm Dickie Greenleaf," that it was rather like a Grimm's fairy tale, like a contemporary Grimm's fairy tale, that be careful of what you wish for. I feel the gods laugh at him when he says, "My name's Dickie Greenleaf," and they say, "Well, if that's what you want, you can have it." And it sort of tries to examine the toll involved in giving up on yourself. And so in some ways, it's a nightmarish version of feelings that we've all had. And I think that's what fiction is for in some way, to reflect some of the journeys we might make. Where I understood this film in some way was, you know, partly connected with something that happened to me many years ago, which was that I had written a play, and it was about to be produced in the West End in London, and the director, Michael Blamore, had invited me out to share his house off the coast of France, where we talked about the film, about the play. And we went swimming, and it was a wonderful day, and we were sort of on our backs and speculating about the production of this play and what might happen and what I might rewrite. And then at one point he said, "Oh my goodness, I think we've drifted out from the shore." And I looked back and we were about a mile and a half from land, and I thought, "Well, gosh, I'm going to drown." And I started flailing out and panicking and thinking I'd never get back. And in some ways that seems to me to absolutely corral the emotion and sensation that Ripley experiences in this film, which is that from a series of rather small missteps that he makes, small lies, they accumulate into, you know, a tangled web. And it's in a way, it's I suppose, exacerbating and polarizing the journeys that we all make. We all are guilty of sins of omission and commission about ourselves and our aspirations. And fiction, in some ways, can give you back an exaggerated version of the consequences of those ambitions and desires.
Now, Matt Damon plays Tom Ripley, the character who desperately wants to be this young, wealthy man who he's become acquainted with. And I think it's really an excellent performance. In a way, the role is about acting, because Tom Ripley takes on the character of somebody else. And Matt Damon's face is really interesting to watch in this. You see him as he tries to cover up emotions. You see certain emotions kind of wiping across his face and then disappearing. His face just registers all kinds of interesting, fleeting things. And I'm wondering if you auditioned him for this at all, or just assumed, based on other performances, that he could do what was needed for the role.
Well, I think the casting process is rather like dating blind. You know, you meet somebody and you try and extrapolate from a few hours with them whether you could go on a relationship with them, on an adventure with them. And obviously you have some prior information with an actor because you've seen the work that they've done. Although at the time that I cast Matt, none of the films which had made him Matt Damon actually appeared. I was lucky enough to see an early cut of Good Will Hunting, and then I got to meet him and talk to him. And what struck me about him really was his own passionate conviction that he was well cast in this part, and his really transparent understanding of the screenplay. And I felt great fellow feeling with him. And it was vital in this film that I did have an accomplice on the other side of the camera, because Ripley's in every single scene of the film. I've never really written a character who so dominates proceedings. But the thing that you mentioned is very true about the fact that a great deal of Ripley's performance, of Matt's performance as Ripley, is about watching and observing and reacting. He doesn't have a great number of lines in the film. He's very much a presence rather than a voice. And I think it needs an extraordinary performance to let you in to him. And I tried in a way to make the camera an inquiring camera in this film, inquiring into Ripley's mind, but also in some ways trying to look at the world through his eyes. The film is full of distorted self-images. It's full of a very particular way of seeing. And I kept imagining that the camera was simply reflecting what it was that Ripley saw in the world. And I think that as a performance, it's an absolutely extraordinary one, because it has none of the frills and bells and whistles and pyrotechnics which, you know, normally dignify a great piece of acting. This is all about staying still and allowing the events of the film to wash over you and let people somehow into the secrets that are going on in your head. And I think he has that amazing transparency. He reminded me a great deal of Juliette Binoche in a way, who I think is another actor who you feel privileged when you look at, because you feel that she's inviting you in to the soul in some way. And I think that Matt has pulled off exactly the same remarkable feat in this film, which is that he's first of all, he's transformed himself from who he actually is. I mean, he's a very centered, blessed person, very intelligent, very articulate, stands very steady on his feet, and has that sort of heavy-footed contemporary gait to him. And he's invented this extremely delicate, skinless, febrile character. And that in itself is extraordinary and sustained throughout the film. But also, as you said, there's something that you feel that you have access to the inner being of this character without using any of the tricks that you might need to suggest that. And he also, within the film, recreates himself as somebody else. So there's a whole series of acting exercises going on, and it's a real dignifying, I think, of the screenplay.
My guest is screenwriter and director Anthony Minghella. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Anthony Minghella, director of The Talented Mr. Ripley and The English Patient. Now, you said that part of the reason why you kind of have this sense of empathy for Tom Ripley is that you felt a bit of an outsider growing up in an Italian family that had emigrated to Britain and lived in the Isle of Wight. Now, what part your family, which part of your family came first there? Was it your grandparents, your parents?
Well, it's a very convoluted story, but essentially my mother had fetched up in the Isle of Wight just after the war, but basically on the advice of a priest. Her family had settled from a small village in Italy near Monte Cassino, and her father had disappeared off to Ireland, I think to lead a completely new life, and had abandoned my grandmother and her three daughters. And so with the wisdom and the navigation of the local parish priest in Scotland, where they, for some reason, were living, they were redirected down to the Isle of Wight, a place they'd never heard of, and probably they just wanted to get rid of them. And so it was as far south as you can go in the British Isles. So they went down to the island. And my father, meanwhile, was living in a village very close to Valvery, where my mother came from, and was brought over, as many young men were brought either to America or to Britain, where the wealthy families would pay their train ticket or airfare, and in a way to provide cheap labor. And he was taken in by an ice cream making firm in Portsmouth, which is a few miles from the island. And the people there said, well, you know, there's a girl who comes from a village next door to you in Italy across the way. And so they ended up courting each other on the Isle of Wight ferry, there's a long pier in Ryde, and I think they would trollop and down the pier in the morning, and then my father would go back to the work, and eventually he married, and they settled on the island, and I was born a couple of years later.
Well, as a storyteller, it must have been interesting to grow up with such an interesting story about your own family. Were there a lot of stories in your family about the grandfather who took on a new life and disappeared, abandoning the wife and kids?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that was the whole stuff of my childhood. My grandmother, with whom I was inordinately close. In fact, you know, I don't think it's the closest relationship I've ever had with anyone, probably. And she and I would walk every morning along the beach on the island, and she would, I suppose, explain the world to me as far as she understood it. She was a very naive and wonderful woman, and I don't think ever fully accepted that her husband wasn't going to come back to her. And even though that they'd been separated for 30 years... always imagined he was about to come home. And I think that was the first insight I had into this whole business of the fact that probably my grandfather had a completely new and perhaps fulfilling and perhaps honorable and perhaps appropriate life with somebody else in Ireland, while my grandmother was fantasizing about his return and the inordinate amount of pain that they caused each other, and which stayed with them right up until after my grandfather's death, where... So there were some extraordinary scenes in Dublin where my grandmother and her children went, who are now grown women, went to retrieve the body of their husband and father and bring him back, as it were, because their notion was that this woman might have had him for his lifetime, but they would have him for eternity. I mean, the sort of whole drama of that and just the impact that it had on everybody's lives was, I'm sure, at the beginning of my interest in trying to examine... just the frailty of people pursuing what they feel they need and what they feel they want, and just the yearning that people have for each other and the amount of pain they carry around with each other.
I want to ask you something else about your family. I know your father ended up making ice cream.
Yes, he's a great ice cream maker. He's doing it even as we speak now.
Okay, and I think that there was a brand called Minghella Ice Cream, is that right?
That's absolutely true, yeah.
So were you, I mean, would this have been like being the son of Ben and Jerry's or something, or the son of Seal Test when I was young?
I wish it had been the son of Ben and Jerry's.
Or?
I would never have got a job. I just would have retired by now. Funnily enough, I think one of the Ripley experiences I had when I was growing up was that on the island, which is essentially a very poor place, it's a wonderful place, but the 90% of the population live from hand to mouth. But it has this border of large, you know, of rich people, extremely privileged people who descend in the summer months. It's always been, since Queen Victoria's time, it's been a place where the wealthy and privileged have gone to spend their summers. There's a big, boating regatta there every year, Cowes, which is the home of sailing. And so it was very much the experience of my growing up that the island would become... full, I wouldn't use the word infested, although that was the word that came to my mind. It was full of the young and privileged and gorgeous and wealthy every summer while we were toiling away. And my summers were always spent behind the glass of an ice cream van serving ice cream. And I certainly remember the feeling of not being inside the world I wanted to be in, but rather imprisoned in the cage of this ice cream van. And I remember once driving along, delivering some ice cream in my father's van, and being stopped by two young, very beautiful people who could very well have been Dickie Greenleaf and Marge Sherwood, who wanted me to give them a ride. And so they got into my van, and after a while I asked them where they were going, and they said, "Oh, we're not going anywhere. We just wanted to sort of feel what it was like to be picked up by a local and taken somewhere." And I never felt so humiliated and so clear about my own social standing. And I remember vowing then that I would escape from the prison of the ice cream van and try and reinvent myself. So I suppose that was my most defining Ripley moment.
Before I let you go, I have to ask you, did you ever see the Seinfeld episode, everybody must ask you this, in which Elaine went to see the English Patient and didn't like it, but her boss Peterman loves it, and so rather than get into a fight with him, she tells him she didn't see it. So if he, of course, has to do everything in his power to get her to go because he's sure she's going to love it. Everyone must ask you if you've seen the episode. Did you see it?
Well, you know, I saw a piece of it when I was in Los Angeles. I haven't seen the whole episode. I was enormously flattered that they took the trouble even to... it was an index to me of how much the English Patient had pervaded the public consciousness, that anybody would be remotely amused by this. And in fact, in Britain, there was a much more sort of devastating and just devastatingly funny attack on the English Patient. It was called The Toy Patient, in which they dressed up some bears and, you know... woolen rabbits and played out the story with puppets, and it was much funnier and much better than my film. So, I just took it as a great compliment, really, that anybody cared enough.
I think
the other thing I would say is this, you know, is that I feel so uniconoclastic as a filmmaker, and it's always very strange to me that people can either be so passionately for or against what I'm doing, because I feel like the most equivocal person in the world. And when I made Truly Madly Deeply, I remember that in 1 week, I remember reading a list of somebody's 10 favorite films of all time and getting that glow of pride and reading that somebody thought this was one of the 10 best movies ever made. And the next day on BBC television, they had a wonderful program where people could consign the things they most hated to Room 101, this program was called. And the very first thing on the next day that I saw was this guy saying, "And the first thing I put in Room 101 is Truly Madly Deeply." So it just seems extraordinary to me that such an equivocal person and such an equivocal filmmaker should excite, you know, such extreme reactions in people.
Anthony Minghella directed The English Patient and The Talented Mr. Ripley. Ripley is now out on video. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873, online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN, from World Wildlife Fund, known by its panda logo, working in more than 100 countries around the globe to leave our children a living planet, on the web worldwildlife.org, from BEA, an e-commerce transactions company providing end-to-end solutions for the development and deployment of e-business applications, BEA.com. And from Random House Inc.'s Bantam Books Division, publisher of After the Ecstasy, The Laundry, How the Heart Grows Wise on the Spiritual Path by Jack Kornfield. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, the creator of the X-Men, Spider-Man, the Incredible Hulk, and many other comic book superheroes, Stan Lee. He's the executive producer of the new X-Men movie, which opened today. Also, film critic Henry Sheehan reviews Chuck and Buck. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The new X-Men movie opened today. On this archive edition, we have a 1991 interview with Stan Lee, the executive producer of the film and the creator of such comic book superheroes as the X-Men, Spider-Man, the Incredible Hulk, the Fantastic Four, Iron Man, Silver Surfer, and Doctor Strange. Stan Lee joined Marvel Comics about 60 years ago. He's been Marvel's head writer, art director, and publisher. Now he's Marvel Media's chairman emeritus and CEO of his own company. The X-Men movie is about people who were born with genetic mutations that have manifested themselves into superpowers. One person is telepathic, one is telekinetic, another can manipulate the weather. Although they use their powers for the greater good, they're considered freaks by mainstream society and have become outcasts. A U.S. senator, played by Bruce Davison, is leading a witch hunt against them.
I have here a list of names of identified mutants living right here in the United States.
Senator,
now, here's a girl in Illinois who can walk through walls. Now, what's to stop her from walking into a bank vault or into the White House? Or into their houses.
Senator
Kelly. There are even rumors, Miss Gray, of mutants so powerful that they can enter our minds and control our thoughts, taking away our God-given free will. I think the American people deserve the right to decide whether they want their children to be in school with mutants, to be taught by mutants. Ladies and gentlemen, the truth is that mutants are very real, and they are among us. We must know who they are, and above all, we must know what they can do.
I spoke with Stan Lee after the publication of a book on the history of Marvel Comics. I asked him what makes a superhero a Stan Lee superhero. What are some of the qualities?
Well, it has to be magnificently written. The creation has to be a work of genius. But to be serious, the one thing that I've tried to do is give them the most human and realistic qualities possible. Now, it may sound like a contradiction in terms, because our superheroes are fantasy characters with superpowers that no human being possesses, and yet I try to be realistic about it. But the basic idea is you take one fantastic element, like well, with a Hulk, like somebody who's got the strength of 50 men and green skin. And then you say, suppose such a character really existed. What would his life be like in the real world? Where would he live? What would he wear? Who would he relate to? And so forth. And having asked the reader to suspend disbelief in the area of the character's superpower, you then try to make everything else as realistic as you can. Oh, and then the other thing that we try for very much is humor. Now, I guess before Marvel Comics started, there wasn't too much humor in superhero adventures. But for instance, with Spider-Man, I tried, again, to inject the humor in such a way that it was realistic. For example, there was a time when he had received a check as a reward for something he had done, and he was so happy to have this money, this check made out to Spider-Man, and he went to a bank to cash it in his Spider-Man costume, and the teller behind the counter said, well, I can't cash this check. I need identification. And he said, I'm wearing a Spider-Man costume. He said, anybody could wear a Spider-Man costume. You know, who are you? And he said, I've got a secret identity. I can't tell people who I am. And anyway, this went from bad to worse. And he was never able to cash the check. Now, to me, the interesting thing about that was I really wasn't trying to be funny so much as I was trying to be realistic. Because what would happen if a guy in a Spider-Man suit had a check that he tried to cash?
How did the superheroes that you created compare to the kinds of heroes in comics when you started working at Marvel back when you were a teenager?
Well, when I started working for the comics, all the heroes were really cut out of the same mold. They were tall and handsome and strong and noble, and as far as their dialogue went, I felt insufferably dull.
Give me an example of the type of writing you thought was really square and dull.
Okay. I want you to imagine something. I want you to imagine that you're walking down the street and you see a monster coming toward you. And this monster is 12 feet tall with purple skin, four arms, a tail, and he's breathing fire, and he's got two heads. And if in those days, if Superman or Batman or one of our own characters, Captain America or anybody, any typical superhero, had seen this monster walking down the street in one of the stories, I think the dialogue would have gone something like this. Oh, a creature from another world. I'd better capture him before he destroys the city. Well, I would like to feel that in one of our comic books, one of our heroes, such as Spider-Man, might say, who's the nut in the Halloween costume? I wonder what he's advertising. And it was just that shade of difference. I tried to do dialogue that represented the way real flesh and blood, three-dimensional people would talk and would react to things. And it came across as satire. But I wasn't trying to write humor. I was trying to be realistic. So I must be funnier than I thought.
Now, what about deciding on the alliterative sounds that you would use when somebody got hit?
Oh, I loved sounds. And again, I think what it is, I've always hated cliches. As you can imagine, formally in the comics, if somebody was hit or if there was a sound effect of a loud noise, the sound effect would be pow or bam or sock or bop, something of that sort. So I tried to make up crazy sound effects that would at least be original. I would have P-F-Z-Z-A-K-T, which I cannot pronounce, but that might be the sound of a bullet going through a wall or something. One of my all-time favorite sound effects was B-T-K-O-O-M, and it was spelled B-T-K-O-O-O-M, with three O's. And then I put a little asterisk at the end of the word with a note on the bottom of the panel saying the third O, of course, is silent. And so I had fun with the sound effects. As far as the alliterative names, most of our characters had alliterative names. There was Peter Parker and Bruce Banner and Reed Richards. And I had a very pragmatic reason for doing that. I have a terrible memory, always did. And it was difficult for me to remember the names of my characters. But by having the same first letter for a character, if I could remember the Peter, it gave me a clue that the last name also began with P, and I would eventually remember it was Parker, you see. So it made it easier for me to remember the names by giving them the same first letter.
We've been talking about superheroes that you've done, but wasn't there a period when you were also writing Millie the Model and maybe romance comics?
I've written everything, really. Mm-hmm. Before Marvel became big and we were publishing all sorts of comics, we followed the trends. And there would suddenly be a trend for romance comics, let's say. All of a sudden, the romance comics started selling. Well, the minute that happened, we ended up publishing more romance comics than anybody. And I'm afraid we weren't too original in our choice of titles. We had names like My Love, Our Love, Your Love, Their Love, My Romance, Your Romance, Their Romance, and on and on. And then when Westerns would suddenly become popular, we would suspend the love titles and we'd go into Westerns. And my publisher then, he had a thing for the word kid. So we would have the Texas Kid, the Montana Kid, the Dakota Kid, the Nebraska Kid, and Kid Colt Outlaw, which was one of my favorites. I wrote most of all of these. And then we'd have humor magazines and it's slated a little bit more for females. And we had Millie the Model, Tessie the Typist, Nellie the Nurse. And there again, I try to be alliterative, so to speak, with the titles. And then we'd go to animated type comics. We had Silly Seal and Ziggy Pig and Terry Toons, based on the Terry Toon movie characters, and more names than I can remember. Super Rabbit and Floop and Skilly Boo and ridiculous names. Then there were war magazines that were popular at one time, and I was writing Battlefield and Battlefront and Battle Adventures and Battle and War Combat and Combat Kelly and Combat Casey and on and on.
We're listening to a 1991 interview with Stan Lee. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our 1991 interview with Stan Lee, creator of such superheroes as the X-Men, Spider-Man, the Incredible Hulk, and the Fantastic Four. What was the comic book code like when you started working?
Well, it wasn't there when I started working, but when we began to have some pressures from certain groups, we instituted a code that was similar to the motion picture code at that time. And it was what you'd expect. There couldn't be too much untoward sex. The female characters had to be pretty covered up. Just what you'd expect. There mustn't be any blood shown in, if there were any violent battle scenes. Nobody could have a head chopped off, or, you know, the usual things.
Well, things that I wouldn't expect is that the comic book code outlawed the use of werewolves and vampires. I find that hard to understand.
Well, that didn't last very long. I mean, we argued those points, and we finally got them to change that.
So how did it work? Every time you finished a comic, you had to send it to the comic code office?
Yeah, we would send it to them, and except for these one or two instances, there was really no problem. They did a good job, and everything was fine.
You didn't resent their existence?
Not really, no. No. In fact, I thought they served a good purpose because it stopped people from criticizing the comics. And if they did criticize, I would just tell them, call the code.
What kinds of criticism did you get before the code?
Not too many, as a matter of fact. We were too busy just doing our work. We didn't even, until we started Marvel Comics, which was years later, we never got any phone calls. We never got any fan mail. I wish we had. We didn't even get letters of protestation. Occasionally, we'd get a letter from a reader saying something like, I just bought one of your books, and there's a staple missing in the binding, and I want my dime back. And we would be so excited. It was proof somebody had bought a book. We'd hang the letter up on the bulletin board, you know, and be proud of it for a while. It was only after we started Marvel Comics and came out with our new group of superheroes with the so-called new Marvel style that the mail began to really pour in, and it became an avalanche, and that's when everything changed for us.
I'm sure you've been asked this before, but why do superheroes so often wear tights?
I don't know. I think it is simply precedent. It started out that way. The first books, and I wasn't around at that time, had them that way. The funny thing is, when I did our first superhero book, The Fantastic Four, in an effort to avoid the cliché, I told the artist, I don't want costumes on these guys. I just want them to wear clothes. So they didn't have skin-tight costumes. We sent the book out. It was published. We received a lot of fan mail. The kids said they loved it. We knew we had a winner, and we were on our way now. But virtually every letter said, we think it's the greatest book. We'll buy it forever. We love it. Turn out more. But if you don't give them colorful costumes, we won't buy the next issue. And I do not know. I think you'd have to be a psychologist or a sociologist or something and do an intensive study. But there, for some reason, unless these characters are garbed in some sort of outlandish outfit, the readers don't seem to accept that. Even the Hulk. I had no great reason for giving him green skin, except I knew if he had normal colored skin, we probably wouldn't sell as many books. There has to be something colorful about the way they look, visually.
Are you a colorful dresser yourself?
No, I'm the most conservative guy you'll ever see. I wear jeans a lot, but I don't know that that's very colorful.
What about physically? Do you have any special physical strengths?
Oh, I'm incredibly powerful. Right. I've got these broad shoulders and bulging, but no, I'm kind of tall and skinny, and I mean, nobody would ever mistake me for Arnold Schwarzenegger.
I want to get back to what you were saying before, that you couldn't create a character without a colorful costume because the readers swore they'd never read it, no matter how much they love the character.
That's right. I could create it, but it's just, I don't think we would have sold it.
Yeah, right. Well, now, with women superheroes, I bet the equivalent is, no matter how wonderful the character, you have to give her a large bosom or else they won't buy it.
Well, I guess you're right, but I don't know that it's anything sexist as much as symbolic. For example, you'll find that most of the heroes, as I say, they have broad shoulders and big biceps, and, you know, they're all sort of Schwarzeneggers, and most of the women are Marilyn Monroes, and I think it's just that the artists try to draw idealized men and women. And I guess that's the way most people idealize people.
So, Stan Lee, maybe one last thing you can clear up for me before we have to say goodbye. Your birth name is Stanley Lieberman.
No, dear.
Stanley Lieber?
Yeah, I was
Stanley Lieber.
I was born Stanley Martin Lieber, which is a very, I think, lovely, normal name. And as I said, I wanted to write the great American novel. And when I got working in a comic book company, I said, I'm not going to use my name for these silly comics. So I was 17. And when you're 17, you don't know that much. I thought, I need a pen name. And I made up the name Stan Lee, and I started using it. And what happened was, everybody, as the years went by, started to know me as Stan Lee. And nobody knew me anymore as Stanley Lieber. So I would go to buy something and tell them to charge it, and they wanted to see my identification. I said, charge it to Stan Lee. But I had to show them my driver's license, which said Stanley Lieber. And it got so complicated that I finally legally changed my name to Stan Lee, which was a dumb thing to do because Stan Lee is such a stupid name. And people always say to me, Stan Lee what? So I'm thinking of changing my name now to Stanley what? So when they say that, I can say, that's right.
So is Stan Lee short for Stanley or short for
Lieber.
Stan Lieber?
I don't know, really. I can't remember whether I cut Stanley into two names or whether I figured Stan from Stanley and Lee from Lieber. I don't remember what the thinking was, but I figured Stan Lee sounds right for comic books.
Well, it certainly worked, hasn't it?
It hasn't hurt, really.
Stan Lee, thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, it's been a real pleasure, Terry. Thank you for having me.
Stan Lee recorded in 1991. He's executive producer of the new X-Men movie based on his comic book series.
In the chill of night, at the speed of a prime, by the streak of light, he arrives just in time. Spider-Man, friendly neighborhood Spider-Man, welcome fame, he's ignored. Action is his reward to him. Life is a great big bang. Wherever there's a hang-up, you'll find a Spider-Man.
Coming up, a review of the new film Chuck and Buck. This is Fresh Air. Chuck and Buck is a new dark comedy from the independent filmmaker who made Star Maps. It's written by Mike White, who also stars as Buck. White has been a writer and producer for the TV shows Dawson's Creek and Freaks and Geeks. Henry Sheehan has a review.
American independent cinema is awash with stories of young people coming to terms with their sexuality. Hollywood churns out one teen sex comedy after another. And the primetime TV schedule is crammed with serial dramas of gorgeous actors in their 20s acting out what would normally be teendom's pimply passions. And all this is turned out by young filmmakers who, more than anyone else, should know better. For that reason alone, I would find the unnervingly funny independent film Chuck and Buck appealing. For once, we have a young hero, anti-hero really, whose sexuality is neither sympathetic nor airbrushed. In fact, Buck O'Brien is downright creepy. Buck is 27 years old, has the mind and the bedroom of an 11-year-old, and when the movie opens, has just been hit with the death of his mother. An unexpected guest at the funeral is childhood friend Chuck Sitter. Chuck and Buck haven't seen each other for 16 years, but they used to be best friends. Buck can't see why they still can't be, even though Chuck has clearly grown up. He's a record company executive and is about to marry his girlfriend, Carlin. In this early scene from the movie, back at the house after the funeral, Buck tries a little too eagerly to rekindle that friendship.
You want to go see my room? This is my mom.
She's pretty.
She would have hated this. All these people in her house. It's kind of strange to see you after all these years. I mean, under these circumstances. Guess who this is? It's me and Chuck.
Chuck?
I go by Charlie now, pretty much. Chuck and Buck.
That's so adorable. Look at you guys. You're such little cuties.
I have a whole box of pictures. You guys should spend the night. We gotta get back. We got a flight at 8 o'clock. No, back to L.A. You live there, too?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we live together.
Buck goes to L.A., where he begins to stalk Chuck, or Charlie, as his victim prefers. Buck is played by Mike White, who also wrote the movie. White is a writer, not an actor. He has spent the last few years as a writer on the glossy TV teen show Dawson's Creek and a writer-producer on the less glamorous but still fantasy-driven Freaks and Geeks. But his impersonation of Buck is flawless. Yes, he captures the emotionally and mentally arrested man's vulnerability, but even better, he captures Buck's obliviousness, the failing that combined with his fixation makes him a pest. While I was watching the movie, I felt my sympathies perched on a razor's edge, pushed this way and that by Buck's undulations from pathos to creepiness. But Charlie isn't just an innocent victim. It quickly becomes clear that there is more to his friendship with Buck than he lets on. Played by Chris Weitz, who directed last year's American Pie with his brother Paul, Charlie keeps a fierce grip on his regular guy facade, even if that means treating Buck with rudeness and cruelty. And just when you begin to think that Charlie is a jerk, Buck lets him know exactly what he wants out of their relationship, a resumption of pubescent sexual experimentation. Yikes. So Buck's a fixated obsessive and Charlie a guilt-ridden repressive, right? That's what I thought. Pat psychodrama. But while all this is going on, Buck is using his inheritance to stage a play in a children's theater across the street from Charlie's office building. It's called Hank and Frank, involves two friends and an evil witch, and a secret in the woods. Even Buck's director, who is marvelously portrayed by the veteran actress Lupe Oniveros, thinks she's got a psychological allegory on her hands. Or as she tells Buck, "I think you've got a real problem with women. And I think you've got a real problem with men." But Buck responds, "It's a fairy tale. Haven't you ever read fairy tales?" Then it strikes you that in psychodramas, characters tend to be shrunken down to the sum total of their neuroses. But in fairy tales, what appear to be simply drawn figures quietly grow to a size that withstands multiple interpretations. Ultimately, when Buck makes his final pleas to Charlie, he rests him on his needs as a person, not his symptoms as a case. Chuck and Buck was well directed by Miguel Arteta, who used film and star maps but switches to digital video here. The grainy, electronic feel of video gives Chuck and Buck an appropriately voyeuristic look. Arteta is generous with the time he gives the characters, standing among them like an attentive guest at a party getting steadily out of control. Unlike those parties, Chuck and Buck ends without either trash or bodies strewn on the floor. The ending is so neat that it's a problem, a wish-fulfillment scheme that White seems to have borrowed from one of his TV programs. But that's a single blemish on a very human, if unbeautiful, piece of work.
Henry Sheehan is film critic for the Orange County Register. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer this week is Roberta Sharrock. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. And Maria Baldonado directed the show. I'm Terry Gross, and before I go, I want you to know that Tuesday will feature an interview with songwriters Barry Mann and Cynthia Weil, whose hits include On Broadway, Uptown, We Gotta Get Out of This Place, and this song.
You never close your eyes anymore. Your lips. There's no tenderness like before in your fingertips. You're trying hard not to show it, but baby.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we continue our Monday encore presentations of our series on American popular song with the music of Will Marion Cook, the principal composer of the 1903 musical Indahome, the first Broadway musical written and performed by African Americans. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.